coming off of, you know, 2025, it might have been the lowest crime rate in 125 years. Fentanyl deaths have dropped from 300 a year to, but I think it's dropped down to, you know, under 25.
When I was in narcotics, it was crack. But this fentanyl thing, obviously, that's a problem worldwide.
We've hit them pretty hard. When one interdiction traffic stop, we got 150,000 fentanyl pills just in one stop. We started Operation Safe Road. We haven't had a fatality accident in Tarrant Counties since October.
What is your relationship with ICE, and how does that help to avoid what has happened in Minnesota?
We work with ICE every day. ICE isn't trained to make traffic stops. They're not trained to be these street cops, obviously, but Minneapolis is.
Probably the most important thing is family, right? It's who we go home to at night.
We have 10 kids. The two oldest are biological. The lower eight are adopted. And we didn't plan to adopt. We felt called to it.
Every time I, you know, either have a conversation with you over text or we, you know, grab lunch together, I just feel like, okay, I just need to be a better person overall. So that really just kind of shows just the man of character you are, you know, not just a Texas, quintessential Texas lawman, but a true family man with a heart bigger than you can even describe.
Welcome to Proud American Studios in a new episode of The Hero Next Door. In every town and every street, heroes live amongst us. Today, we have one of those heroes, Sheriff Bill Wayburn from Tarrant County, Texas. How you doing, Sheriff?
Great to be here, and I'm doing fantastic.
Fantastic. Well, my name is Darcy Lutzinger. By way of where I came from, law enforcement here in Metro Detroit, Warren, Michigan, lieutenant for 27 years. And I am really excited to hear about your story, where you came from, how you get started. But we're going to do some introductions around the board right here. We're going to start with Michael first.
Hey there, Sheriff. Mike Koselniak here, retired Homeland Security Investigations, 26 years in law enforcement, was a state trooper prior to that. Happy to have you on the show today.
Sheriff, great seeing you again, as always. Trey Lindsay here, former Navy SEAL, current veteran entrepreneur, and also a sworn law enforcement professional in the state of Texas.
All right, Bill, you know the crew now, okay? So we're going to kind of get right into it. I want to really start back at the beginning with you. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and what got you into law enforcement at the beginning.
Well, once again, it's good to be here. I grew up in a small town in southern eastern New Mexico called Jal, New Mexico, and grew up out there, and you were either going to be in the cattle business or you were going to be in the oil and gas business. But it's a great place to grow up. When I grew up there, it's kind of like a Mayberry, and, you know, small town, double A football. And, you know, if you're not at a football game on Friday night, police might stop you and say, what are you doing? But that's where I grew up, and I did eventually end up moving to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, to Arlington, and finished high school here, and worked for just a little bit, and then went into the Air Force.
What was the transition out of the Air Force into law enforcement? How did you make that leap?
Well, it was excellent. I mean, the Air Force did a great job. They set the table for me and paid for me to go through a police academy while I was still in active duty. And I was able to do that. And then when I transitioned out, I already had a job and went right straight to work. And I was in a small agency in that agency within just a few years. The city council, the chief resigned, and they asked me to take the helm, and I did, and thought it was going to be just for a little while, and ended up being about 30 years.
I've read somewhere that you were kind of a young chief.
I was, at the time, the youngest chief that we knew of in Texas. I don't know what those people were smoking to hire me.
Were you prepared at all? I mean, I just want to get this, because you probably held a lot of different jobs before you came the chief, didn't you? I mean, usually you go through a long career of, you know, undercover, narcotics, a lot of different things. It sounds like you jumped right up to the chief job almost.
Well, we did do some of that, but I mean, I didn't do any undercover work, but my Air Force career, I was on an anti-terrorist team, and I was NCOIC of it at the time. It gave me a lot of leadership skills that bled over, and, you know, I carried with me, and as I think Trey would attest, as the non-commissioned officers run the show, and so I had some opportunities to do that. And then when I got in, I did promote fairly quickly in that agency, and was helping organize and run things. And it was a small agency, and then you know, when the chief left, it was kind of, you know, I was a little bit worried. I mean, you know, the best, you know, I was watching what Andy Griffin did on Mayberry and trying to go from there.
That's great. Well, I'm sure we're going to get a lot into your career and the different things you've done, because it's been long and industrious. You're still working, which is great. But let's start off with Mike. You want to start us off with some questions, Mike?
Sure. So Sheriff Wayborn, you mentioned you were prior military and a prior military veteran. Can you tell us a little bit about your service with the military and how those skills you learned in the military translated over into law enforcement?
I absolutely can. When I went in the Air Force, I joined and I said I wanted to be a cop and I wanted to see the world. And I went to Lackland Air Force Base and went through boot camp down there and training down there, including at that time the Security Police Academy and then to the combat skill trainings that we did. And it, you know, a lot of that really started right there with, you know, you had to have the discipline, the mindset to make it through the day, whether you're doing that, you know, 5 or 10 mile hike and in full gear or those kind of things. And when I say leadership issues, is that teaching that you got to persevere, you got to get to the end, you got to have an end in mind, and you got to get to it, our mission accomplished. And then when I finally got to base, you know, at that time, Air Force Security Police were the largest in the world. I mean, we were 42,000 strong. There was a bunch of us. And so we had several different missions. And my mission that I was assigned to eventually was nuclear, you know, securing our nuclear assets. And I didn't lose any, by the way.
That's always good.
Yeah, it's always good. And but also, as I transitioned to a young NCO, is they sent us right straight to school, and they started talking about, you know, the people that I was growing up under and the commanders that I had was take care of your people. It's really a early servant leadership at that moment. It's take care of the people, try to address their needs, lead from the front, and again, persevere and complete the mission. Don't stop, you know, and constant training to that effect of what we were to be doing.
I know in my law enforcement career, a lot of the guys I worked with, especially in the state police, had prior military service. And a lot of those skills, as you just mentioned, do translate. Now, you as a chief or sheriff, do you look to hire prior military guys into the department? Is that something you look for?
I love prior military people, and because they come with that, they already come with that set. They come with the discipline. They come with, and we encourage, by the way, if you're here, go into the reserves, even though sometimes that catches us short, but prior military guys always generally have a leg up, and we have a bunch of them from all walks.
Hey, Sheriff, let's go back to the beginning of your law enforcement career again. So as you mentioned before, you were promoted to chief of police at a very young age. But for the viewing audience to know that, so you start off in Dow Worthington Gardens Police Department in April 1981, if my memory serves me correctly, after your active duty service. And as you mentioned before, you were promoted to chief of police June of 1984, making you the youngest chief of police in Texas at the time, probably still to this day, I would imagine. How was that feeling of having such a high level of responsibility in law enforcement at such a young age, being the chief of police?
Well, I will tell you that fortunately, even when that happened, I had some really, really good people around me and some prior military. In fact, you know, at that time, Vietnam vet, combat veterans right there alongside of me that had led in the field. So I was blessed to have those people around me. And then, you know, the other thing the Air Force taught me was that you better be investing in yourself. You better be looking at the next skill level. You better be looking at how to sharpen the saw, as Stephen Covey would say. And so those were some of the things that I was doing. But I would tell you that initially I was absolutely overwhelmed and thinking, you know, who can I call if I need help? And that was the people that I was identifying, and that was other chiefs. And I was blessed to have a great number of really good chiefs that I got to watch and grow up under.
Awesome. And so you made the transition and adjustment from being a chief of police and officially entering the world of politics and domestic law enforcement when you ran for sheriff and won. How was that transition from an appointed chief of police to now an elected official being a sheriff?
Well, the one of the things is I joke I don't have to keep my mouth shut anymore.
Yeah, perfect. Nice.
I can say what I think, and so we're doing that and getting in a little bit of trouble from time to time. But is that transition was huge when I went from being a chief to a sheriff. As you know, the leadership was still the same. That's just size difference and so forth like that. I did have to learn to not get into the weeds as much in a large organization as I did in a small organization. So I knew that I needed to be doing that. But the thing that it happens is that 24/7 as a chief, I was on call. So that wasn't a big deal. And as a sheriff, 24/7, I'm under a microscope. Mm-hmm. So whatever I do, the media will twist it how they do things. Those kind of things will happen all the time. But I think if that makes sense, I went from being on call 24/7 to being under a microscope 24/7. And not that I wasn't as chief under have accountability. It just wasn't as big a deal. They look to see what the sheriff's going to be doing.
That makes sense. Well,
plus, you've got a whole county now instead of a city, right? So you've got the jail, you've got the county, you're answering to a lot more people, right?
Absolutely. 2 million people in this county, and they are the boss. So they get to decide whether I stay or go. And you're right, the county jail is probably 60% of my job. And, you know, I woke up this morning with a little over 4,600 inmates.
Wow.
And so we are going big guns and that's kind of thing. But 60% of my job is the jail, and then the other 40% is operational things that normal police departments do.
From an ops standpoint, what is the biggest challenges that's going on in your county right now?
The biggest challenge from internal is going to be that we have, 160 openings for jailers and nearly, 35 openings for deputies. And in the DFW area, from the personnel, we're always stealing from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody gets ahead in pay, your people are going to get solicited for, the grass is greener over here. Mm-hmm. So that is going on all the time. Externally, we're just coming off of, 2025, if it continues to tabulate the way it's tabulating, when they finish up from the federal level, it might have been the lowest crime rate in 125 years. Just incredible. And since the administration changed, our fentanyl deaths have dropped from 300 a year to, I haven't even seen it recently, but I think it's dropped down to, under 25. So we're seeing markedly things there. And the other big challenges that we have had, quite frankly, besides crime and so forth like that, is we were having a problem with traffic fatalities. And we got together with all the police chiefs and we started Operation Safe Road, where we're paying a lot more attention to traffic and making traffic stops. And knock on wood, we haven't had a fatality accident in Tarrant County, not in the cities, but in Tarrant counties since October. And so we're doing great in those areas.
Chief, so I was a prior narcotics officer here in the Metro Detroit area for 25 years. When I was in narcotics, it was crack, okay? And cocaine was the big deal back then, right? But this fentanyl thing that you just brought up with, obviously, that's a problem worldwide. You said that your numbers are down considerably. What do you attribute that to? Is it enforcement? Is it better knowledge? Is it better saving them at the hospitals? What do you think it is?
I think it's a combination is that the border shutting down has been phenomenal. The second thing is that we have enforcement. We still hit enforcement, and we knew that battling the cartel, that they probably had stockpiles in the United States, and we've hit them pretty hard. Right here in Tarrant County, 2 months ago, we on one interdiction traffic stop, we got 150,000 fentanyl pills just in one stop. So I think we've had some big loads take away all across the United States, where we're still hitting the cartel pretty hard. And also what DEA has told us is that in 2024, 6 out of 10 fentanyl pills that were being manufactured by the cartels were deadly. Well, as of just a month ago in the recent test through late 25 and now, that has dropped to only instead of 6 out of 10, it's like 3 out of 10. So the sources are drying up, and it's a combination of enforcement. It's a combination of closing the border. And also I have to say some education. I think people are now more aware of how deadly that is.
Yeah. Well, especially the officers are coming in contact daily with it, right?
Daily. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, well, right here on my desk, if you can see it, mm-hmm. is I got, you know, my Narcan's right there, and I've got it in my vehicle. I, you know, often have it in my pocket. We have it with us all the time.
So, Sheriff, you've been heavily involved in a lot of the Texas state legislative sessions, from pioneering the Texas DUI no refusal program, along with the Chris Kyle law. Can you share with our audience what some of those laws are exactly? Any current legislation, legislation that you are behind?
The DWI law was that back in 2005, what we saw is across the state on enforcing DWI that we were having a 50% conviction rate. We were losing 50% of the cases that we were filing. And it was because people were refusing the breathalyzer and, you know, just doing some research. And, we were at that point DPS. We were both medical and police. And it was very clear in all the legal research and everything else, the gold standard was blood. So what we did was we trained law enforcement officers to be blood technicians, and we'd make an arrest on a DWI and we'd take them to the station. We had a safe draw room and we'd have somebody draw their blood. Well, initially our conviction rate went from 50 to 100% because we had the gold standard. We had the blood. And so there was a lot of battles. It went completely up to the Fifth Circuit. And they said it was constitutional in what we were doing. And that was our federal appeals court, and went up to the Supreme Court, and they said it was settled law. So that's how we won that. And a lot of battles in Austin over that, but we were able to come out on the top side of it. Chris Kyle bill. Chris was going through the process of trying to become a police officer with me back in 2013 when he unfortunately was murdered. And out of that is that a group of people were together and said, you know, it's just like you, Trey, is that we were talking and saying, why do we have to send these people through a 20-week, 3-week academy if they have the skills that we need already, and just take the skills that we need to teach them and try to do something different? And this was for special forces. This was for military police. But it also was expanded to an electrician in the Army or a plumber in the Army, that they could come out and be licensed in Texas. And what we came up with the Chris Kyle bill is peace officers or guys coming out of the military could apply, and they could take some courses, you know, two or three, you know, I guess it's probably 140 online and another 60 or so in the academy. So markedly reduce the academy and go out. Now, I remember testifying and talking about the great American sniper and saying, so he would, if he went through a regular academy, we'd spend 40 hours at least, maybe 48 hours on the gun range. And what is he going to learn? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's things that we could do to be efficient and to allow those people to transition more quickly into law enforcement. And I've got several of those working right here that have done that. Got one in the mix right now that was in special forces, and he's going to be able to do the Chris Kyle bill.
Sheriff, I think that's such a very powerful piece of legislation that I think a lot of folks, you know, military police and also special operations, personnel, they're still on active duty, but do want to, or at least looking post-military life, getting into law enforcement. I think that's very important that actually they need to use that even more of it as a recruiting tool. Just like as the sheriff said, so I was able to get my Texas Commission on Law Enforcement license through the military police program to actually cut down my hours even a little bit more than the special operations background program, because I was a Master of Arms and Navy cop before I went and became a SEAL. So I think it's really important for our viewing audience, especially any military personnel that are interested in joining law enforcement post-military life, to really take a hard look at that, some of the Texas state legislator and also the TECO, the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement website, to really show and highlight some of those opportunities to have a streamlined commissioning process. So really, I thank you. Thank you again for sharing that, Sheriff. I think that was one of the most powerful pieces of legislation for military veterans that you could have been a part of, and I know you spirited that. So again, thank you for that, sir.
Well, no, you're welcome, and thank you for coming across and becoming a sworn peace officer. We need a bunch more just like you.
Hey, Sheriff, that's incredibly progressive. We're in Michigan and on the East Coast. I've never heard anything like that before. Do you know if any other states are doing it?
There was, Florida might have been considering it, but I don't know. I haven't checked with my friends in Florida to see if it's passed.
Yeah, it seems like something that should be brought up to the IACP, the International Association of Chief of Police, because it makes all the sense in the world. They're having such a hard time right now, as you know, with recruiting and finding the right people to come in. And if you can make the transition fast, easier, like it was for Trey, and just concentrate on the areas that need to be, because you need to get them on the road, right? You need to get them on the job. And the faster you can get them out there, the better it's going to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think it has been a very successful program, and it would be great to see other states come alongside of us and continue that and honor the service. Now, you know, all of us being cops, the taxpayers have spent money on our training. And if you look at somebody like Trey, my gosh, you know, we got a couple of $1 million invested in him.
Right. Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, hopefully some of our subscribers, our listeners, and people that are tuning into this can maybe make that happen, and we can see that move across the rest of the country, because that'd be great for everybody, wouldn't it?
That'd be great for everybody.
Let's kind of transition over a little bit. I love to talk about education and law enforcement, because I think it's such an important thing, especially guys our age, to continue education, to always keep learning, to keep at the top of our game. Can you tell me a little bit about your background as it relates to education, and then maybe some of the special courses or the training that you've had?
Well, I have a bachelor's degree in criminal justice, and I used to introduce myself this way, and I have a master's degree in conflict management from a seminary. And I tease people sometimes when I talk about those two degrees. You know, I finished my bachelor's and figured out there really was crime in the world, and master's in conflict, there really was some conflict. You know, I guess I didn't realize it until I finished those degrees. So that was my formal education. I'm a graduate of the FBI National Academy. Done that. I've done the leadership course at Eastern Kentucky University that they used to have. I'm not even sure if it still exists, but it used to exist at kind of the Midwest Leadership Academy for the United States for law enforcement in Kentucky. I've done several of those things. And then I've had the run of the mill things that we all have to have. And probably, you know, I don't know, I'm probably at 5,300 training hours in the classroom or practical training. And, but you're right. We all are still learning, and, it's an ever changing thing. And as I tell people, it's really a practice, and, it's running and gunning every day.
Let's, while we're on top of training, Chief, you know, it seems to be, because I've got a son in law enforcement, I'm still connected to the community a lot in law enforcement, and everybody says there's no time to train anymore. You know, we've got to go out on the road. We've got to answer calls. And back in the day, you can go to an off-duty roll call, and they had a whole list of trainings that you can go to, you know, from defensive tactics to the new handcuffing techniques, whatever. And now it's just this, we got to get out on the road. Are you doing anything special for the people under your organization to make sure that, because you know, the first thing when they get sued, they're going to want to know about the policies and procedures that they followed and what training they have. So can you tell me about your thoughts about that?
You're absolutely correct. And it is tough to edge in training, but we are sacrificing and trying to get that done. And like for the jail, our jail folks, where we're really short, it's been very difficult. So we have literally, we have three jail instructors assigned to the jail. That's what they do. They're inside the brick and mortar of the jail, and they're training at briefings. They're training in pods. They're training officers while they're actually working. And so we are doing those things, and it seems to, we've only started, it's a couple of years old, but it seems to be working. And for the operation side of the house, the patrol officers or the special bureau guys, we are still trying to send them to training, and we just know that we're going to have to, you know, cinch up the belt. And they've got to get out there. But I think I made a speech in Washington a few weeks ago, and what I was talking about, the law enforcement officer today, as we try to recruit more, is I want to remind people, we are at least, and this applies to everybody in law enforcement, in my opinion, that are operational is that we're at least a second or third cousin, maybe third, but I think second cousin to our special operators that are in the field. We want police officers to be independent. We want them to be able to do their job. We want them to be able to drive well. We want them to be able to, if they have to use force, that they know what level of confidence of level of force that they need to use. Is we're really a second cousin to special ops, and we need to treat them as such and continue those skills. We often forget where we send people to tons of shooting classes, but while that's important, God forbid it, you know, as it comes up, but we forget the most deadly thing they do every day is drive. And so we're right now, hopefully in about 6 weeks, it's been a long time coming, we're going to be opening up a new academy, nearly a 50,000 square foot academy, and we're going to have simulation driving, simulation shooting. We're going to have it to the point where a shift commander on midnight shift can set up things where he runs his guys through driving and shooting scenarios in one night, where they're not going to be in there for 8 hours, but you might come off the street for 35 or 40 minutes, hit a scenario, have to drive, transition over, shoot, don't shoot, a crisis intervention. And that's where we really need to be. And we're really big on mental health interdiction also.
Well, Sheriff, if I can interject real quick, you brought up such a great point comparing a lot of law enforcement officers on the streets to some of our special operations forces. And I know that's me beginning the training world post-military life. That's always been a hot topic of sometimes executive leadership really doesn't want to even have like former special operations military personnel training domestic law enforcement. They think those worlds are two different worlds altogether. But one thing I really want to highlight that you brought up with our viewing audience that I've even ran to myself doing like various trainings I've done. If I'm doing like, you know, active shooter and active threat type course, I always am telling the attendees, the officers and deputies that are attending it, no matter what your background is, I always refer them to a tactical law enforcement officer. And I get comments all the time, but, well, I've never been a SWAT, I'm not SRT, I'm not this and that. I'm like, folks, trust me, you find yourself on an active shooter, active threat incident where you're the first responding officer and there is kids or innocent, you know, civilians being killed inside, you're going to become a tactical law enforcement officer real quick, whether you want to or not. So I think it's very important for the viewing audience to really understand the importance of, yes, it is different worlds, but at the same time, when you are responding to a critical incident and there are innocent, you know, lives on the line, there is a lot of similarities as far as some of the tactics, techniques, and procedures officers can use that are taught in the special operations community, still within the U.S. rule of law, that will ensure that the threat gets stopped as soon as it possibly can and innocent life is preserved. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, Sheriff. I think it's very important for our viewing audience to hear that more often.
I thank you, and I think it is important that we kind of know where we're at and who we are. But I mean, cops get credibility with each other if they have proverbially wrestled the guy in the bar ditch, you know, the drunk in the bar ditch or whatever, and that's credibility or street cred, as it were. But we got to remember, we better teach them how to wrestle in the ditch, and so we've got to do it all.
So, Sheriff, you mentioned before the size of the population in your county, and at any given time, you may have 4,000 or more guests at your correctional centers. What is your relationship with ICE, and how does that work in your department? And, you know, is that relationship a good one? Do you guys regularly meet? And then having that kind of a relationship with ICE, how does that help to avoid what has happened in Minnesota?
We have an excellent relationship with ICE, and we have a 287G program that I put in place in 2018, which means that our guys inside the jail are federal officers that can put detainers on people. Today, just information for you guys is that we've got nearly 400 people detained in our jail, but they're there on serious charges, including murder. We've got some cartel hit guys. We've got aggravated sexual assaults of children. These are real bad guys. We work with ICE every day. They pick people up out of our jail every day. And in contrast with what happened in Minneapolis is that the failure up there, and I believe, guys, quite frankly, politically speaking, is that the mayor and the governor were tremendously at fault for what happened. If Minneapolis PD would have been out there on the road, would have been out there running interference with ICE officers, there's a good possibility none of this would happen. ICE isn't trained to make traffic stops. They're not trained to be these street cops, obviously. But Minneapolis is. And I think that that PD, if they could have gotten involved, I think we'd have seen a whole different outcome. That's happening in Memphis, Tennessee right now, is that they're there. They're working with them. Memphis PD's running with them and taking care of those issues.
I think what a lot of people don't understand, Sheriff, is in a sanctuary city, those you talk about the 400 incarcerated inmates you have right now under ICE detainers. When those individuals are released, they will be turned over to ICE, whereas ICE will come right into the jail, handcuff them in a safe environment and bring them to their next stop, whether that's deportation or wherever they're heading to next, as opposed to a sanctuary city where they'll be released on the street and those ICE agents now need to go out and find those individuals and risk themselves and the public. Can you just expand upon that?
Absolutely. Isn't that a crazy thing? You're exactly right. They come into my jail. It's safe and secure. They handcuff them, put them in a vehicle, and they're off. And when we turn them loose, you know, when we turn these guys loose out in the community, and some of them, again, you know, murderers, rapists, and they make bond and they walk out the door. They're in the community, still a threat to the community. And it puts ICE in danger. It puts the community in danger and other law enforcement agencies in danger. And it is beyond me why they will not assist federal agents doing their job. You know, I've been a cop a long time. I would have never thought I would have seen this.
Personally had friends get injured in this exact environment where they were being released. So we appreciate your policies there. That's, you know, from a former HSI guy, it goes a long way, and it's what keeps the general public safest. So just shifting gears a little bit, in 2024, you won a really tough election campaign. There was a lot of negative influence from the outside to try to get you out as sheriff of Tarrant County. How did that have an effect on your professional and personal life?
Well, I tell you, I woke up probably 15 days out from that election, and every morning when I woke up, I want the news. You know, you pick up the proverbial phone, and 15 days out, there was a negative headline about me every morning. And it was from all over the place. It wasn't even Texas. I mean, I tell people the Houston Chronicle, a religious writer, came after me. And I was trying to think, well, he doesn't know me, but, it was tough on my personal life. My kids saw all that negative stuff. My wife is okay. You know, she's tough as nails, but you know, it was that way. I've got an older son that he is in law enforcement, and you know, he had to be careful. He's in municipal law enforcement, and he had to be pretty careful where he is, and because people were upset. And then there was a lot of death threats that spun off of that. And traditionally, when we get those things, I'll call my wife and give her as much information about what I know, the person that wants to kill me. And her response is, tell them to get in line. You know, the way it is. But is professionally, most of the people knew the truth. The people spinning the lies were a radical left groups, and it was over deaths in custody. And where I made my mistake is that I was transparent during COVID, when we were having a lot of deaths in the jail from COVID. And by the way, both were losing officers to COVID as well. And I started doing press releases when we had a death in custody. Well, I was the only one. So I've got other major counties that are around me or in the state, but I was the only one doing press releases. And of course, once you start it, you can't really stop it. And so they came after me for killing all these people and thinking that. But, you know, I educated them that 98% died in the hospital. They had chronic issues when they came into jail. They were dying from cancer, cardiac arrest. You know, you do heroin for 30 years, it's going to catch up to you. And that's some of the things that were going on. And the radical left would have none of that. And in fact, I had invited the DOJ in 24, early 24, the National Institute of Counties, which is a piece of DOJ, and they came down and did a full-blown inspection of my jail, how I was doing things, what I was doing, and everything else. And the brief out was, is I had the Cadillac model of a jail. I mean, that's what they said. And we're helping them today, and we're helping others agencies today to figure out what we were doing. But I'm the third largest county in Texas. And last year, in 25, the third largest county, I was number five in custody deaths. The other four agencies were having more than me.
So the sheriff and I have been friends since, you know, at least 10 plus years. And I knew, like, you were in a hard fought battle. You know, I was texting you leading up to it. But on the night that I saw that you'd won re-election, I immediately texted you, let you know, like, hey, congratulations on the big, big re-election win. And that is just the biggest example that I could find that I knew of where good triumph over evil. So I just want to make sure the viewing audience understood that as far as everything you went through on the personal and professional side. And just that's the best example of good triumphing over evil that I could find for the, you know, anytime soon. So,
well, thank you, Troy.
Hey, Sheriff, let's talk about probably the most important thing is family, right? It's who we go home to at night. And that's the main thing that your officers, you want for your officers, you want for yourself, is to get home safely every night to our family. Like you, I have adopted kids. So I hold a special place in my heart for people that do that. Tell me about your family.
Well, we have 10 kids. The two oldest are biological. The lower eight are adopted. And, we didn't plan to adopt. We felt called to it. And, we started this crazy adventure in late 2002, when a group of Russian orphans came over. And they were trying to put these kids with families, and they did 14 out of 15. There was one boy going back that wouldn't have a family, and I had no idea of the flight of the Russian orphan at that point. And in Russia, if you're an orphan and in an orphanage at 16, they're done. You see you later. We're done. And so I think a lot of people, you know, human trafficking and drug smuggling and all that, that these kids are being used for. So it was heartbreaking. And we ended up, long story short, we went to Russia and we adopted a young man, and we got him home, and everything was going great. And then he realized his best friend was about to age out, and he had two brothers. And we checked, my wife is a little social worker, and she was able to figure that all out, is those boys wasn't up for adoption. I mean, up for a national adoption, which had to be for a year. And then, I remember him asking, what can we do? And I said, there's nothing we can do except pray for those kids. That's all we got. 6 weeks later, all three of them were on the international adoption list, and they were coming to Texas through an orphanage program. And we were asked to be a host, and we did. And we ended up saying that we would adopt them, and they went back to Russia, and we had to go over there for a this crazy story. We had to go back over there for a court, and so we were waiting on that in the fall of 04, and had another person I knew that her daughter was pregnant. She didn't need the baby. She was struggling with some dope, and would I help see if I could find a family to adopt this child? And we had a family. We went to her. She declined and said no. And when we left there, my wife went and told that prospective family that wasn't going to work out. But and that woman said, well, I've been praying about this, and I don't think it was our baby anyway. It was your baby. And so I got home, and my wife announced, she says, what if we adopt him? And I called the woman the next day, and she said, I'll call you back in 24 hours. Which was a Thursday afternoon. And my wife asked her, she says, I want you y'all to take the baby home from the hospital. My wife said, what is your due date? She said, oh, I'm having a C-section at 10 a.m. in the morning. So we weren't pregnant, but about a few hours.
Jeez.
God bless. Yeah.
And then after that group, we adopted a little girl who was being medically abused by her mother with Munchausen by proxy. Mm-hmm. Subject of a book called The Mother Next Door, and her name is Alyssa, and Alyssa was horrifically tortured with several surgeries that she does not need. She was starved to death, nearly caused septic two or three times. And in the hospital, we caught her. The way we caught her is that Alyssa was flourishing in a hospital bed, and the woman, crazy woman, took feces and urine and put it in her feeding tube to cause her to go septic. And but good medical staff took care of that. And we got Alyssa, and she's doing great. She's turning 18 day after tomorrow.
Wow.
Growth is a little bit smaller than that from the starving and so forth like that, but she's doing good. And then we adopted a six-month-old who his mother at 6 weeks swung him around and beat his head up against the table and caused 19 fractures. And several ribs broken, legs broken. And we got him, and then we adopted a little boy that had been adopted out of China at the age of four. And these parents, when they by the age of nine, they were trying to readopt him, which is kind of a crazy deal. But we ended up with him at 12, and he's graduated and down in South Texas trying to make a life for himself. And but there's the nickel tour of these the crazy world in which I live in.
Yeah.
And I tell people that politician that's messing with Russia and China, you got me.
Well, God bless you and what you've done for these
Sheriff,
kids.
If you, yeah, Sheriff, if you don't mind me sharing, I was telling the guys leading up to this, we were going to have you on the program, that every time I, you know, either have a conversation with you over text or we, you know, grab lunch together and you start talking about your family, your adopted kids and how everyone's doing, like, I just feel like, okay, I just need to be a better person overall. So that really just kind of shows the, just the man of character you are, you know, not just a Texas, quintessential Texas lawman, but a true family man with a heart bigger than you can even, describe. So.
Well, as you know, in my military days, I had a gun blow up in my right ear, and so I'm somewhat deaf in my right ear and not real good with my left ear. And I do worry, as this may be a little sacrilegious, I show up in heaven and I see Jesus waiting on me saying, Wayburn, I said adapt, not adopt. but it's been a bed of roses with some long thorns, as I say.
Oh, that's an amazing story, and bless you and your wife for being able to do that, because to hold a career down, a law enforcement career, is hard enough anyway because of the hours. You're 24/7, 365, and to throw 10 kids into the on top of that, it's just, it's strange, but it shows you what you can do if you want to, right?
Absolutely, and one of the funny stories, just with these kids that didn't speak English, they're speaking Russian. And we got a big family. And like I said, my oldest son's in law enforcement. And we were going somewhere. And long story short, we were going somewhere. And I pull up to a stop sign. And I look over to a field to my left. And it's my oldest son in a fight with two guys on the side of the road that he had just stopped. And, of course, I bailed out and went over there. And these kids, you know, this is what we do. Yeah. You know, this is what we do.
Sheriff, let's switch gears a little bit once again. So we talked a little bit of politics so far, but really let's take a deep dive into that. So again, on the state and national level, you know, for a bit, let's talk about new policy changes with the new administration. With you being a border state sheriff, how has your department been affected from the change in administration and after the election results in 24? And also, please share your thoughts on how the change administrations have even affected the local and state level too. So really the local, state, national level, how have you been affected? Your department has been affected by the change in administration.
First of all, what has happened is the federal government came back to being a partner. You know, in the last administration, no issues with Homeland, no issues with FBI, but certainly ICE at that point, while they were still working with us, they were releasing people right out of my jail into the public. And I mean, I still got 300 or 400 people that are in the wind that were in jail on serious charges. That's not happening now. That has not happened. The sealing of the border has changed the game a whole lot. For instance, you know, you couldn't find a state law enforcement officer in our part of the country because they were all at the border under the Biden administration. Well, now we got those guys back. And, for instance, you know, I got DPS troopers to move back into Tarrant County. They were gone and we've got them back. And, they're part of the reasons that we have really slowed down that fatality rate. So there's a couple of things right there that has been a tremendous change. And I think there's an overall feeling of just feeling safer in our communities. And across the board, you know, on a national level, him sending the military and federal agents into Washington, D.C., which was a crime capital of the world. Hey, I don't know if you've been there lately, but it's safe. Mm-hmm. You can walk around D.C. Everything is good. And tell people this business of crime is not rocket scientist. We find the bad actor and we put them in jail and prosecute them and send them to prison. Crime goes down. And so that's not only happening at the local level, that's happening more at the federal level. And in fact, today is the second day of trial of testimony in the first Antifa prosecution in Texas, right here in Fort Worth, or in the nation. You know, we're trying nine of them for the Prairie Land shooting right now down the street in federal court. So we're seeing aggressive prosecution by the federal government. We're seeing that the border's under control, and the cartel is a mess right now, you know, especially with this last thing that they did, where probably some of your fellow guys in spec ops might have helped with taking out mm-hmm. the big guy down in Mexico. And it's mm-hmm. caused a vacuum down there. And so I think there's some really, really good things happening to make our people safer.
Awesome.
That's great. You're involved heavily in the Texas Sheriff Association, right?
I'm the chairman of major counties in Texas, and I'm the vice president of Major County Sheriffs of America. So those two groups.
Why is it vital then? Because I was involved with the FOP and when I was in law enforcement in Michigan, the Fraternal Order of Police. Why do you think it's vital for officers or leaders like yourself to be involved in these organizations and how they affect law enforcement on the streets?
Well, I will tell you that how important I believe that they are is that if here in Texas, we have 12 major county sheriffs. And by the way, we're both Democrat and Republican, but you know, when it comes to law enforcement issues, you know, we get on the same page, you know, a lot of times. And when we walk into our state representatives' offices, our state Senate offices, they pay attention to us because they know that we represent a lot of people in Texas. And so they want our help, whether we're Democrat or Republican, they want our help. And so when we stand against something, they'll have a tendency to go through it. And I've been involved in that at the Texas level and at a national level because the Major County Sheriffs of America, there's only about 110 of us, but we represent 140 million people. And we've had the blessings of being able to walk into the AG's office, Homeland Security folks' office, counterintelligence office, and not to mention where the policy's been making, but also, you know, like Senator Cruz's office or other senators' offices across the state, our state representatives, and we go in representing that group, it's a pretty strong voice. And recently, we've been able to do, we have a unified sheriff council that also does that all across the country. But along with, we often associate with the major county chiefs. And when you got the major county chiefs and the major county sheriffs in the room, these politicians pay attention.
Yeah. Although, hey, Chief, there's a lot of us, but it sure seems sometimes that we're by ourselves, you know, especially
That's
when
right.
it comes to representation, right? So I think having that voice and having those leaders that have the people to go to that can make change is so important. And that's why I think that role that you're leading with that is probably one of your most important roles.
I agree with you. I think it's very, very important to have that voice. And speaking of legislation, if I may bring up, is that they have right now, and we've killed it 2 years in a row at the national level, and it'll probably come back up again. And it's called, let me see if I get it right, don't mess with my Fourth Amendment. And in that legislation, and you guys know from investigations that we use a lot of open sources and a lot of open sources software, like Clear and some other things like that. Under this legislation, we'd have to get search warrants for open sources. Nobody else would. You know, your kid at home doing a project wouldn't have to do that, but we would. And we've killed that 2 times in a row, but if we wouldn't have been there, it would have passed.
So, Sheriff, you have had such, you have such an immense level of responsibility, being an elected law enforcement official in a major metropolitan area. What areas of concern for public safety do you have for your constituents that you are sworn to protect, and also your concerns for your deputies and personnel working to keep the community safe?
You know, right now, still the drug war is alive and well. That's going on. But the tremendous growth in the mental health area. Our officer-involved shootings, mental health issues. Our domestics, even on the scene, when we get there, we're finding mental health in those issues. Just disturbances on the street. Or, you know, you got somebody that's not right that pulls a weapon on somebody or tries to carjack somebody. We've got to get a handle on this mental health in America. You know, this is all across America, not here, only here, but I have the largest mental health hospital called the county jail, and 60% of the people we check into that have a mental health problem.
Chief, back in the day, we used to be able to take and do medical commitments to numerous hospitals where we're at, and now that's gone. They don't have that anymore. Is it like that where you're at also?
We do have that ability to do mental commitments to hospitals, but they can't be a violent person. So that's a whole different level. And so we've got right now, I just had these figures. I believe I got 140 people or 150 people that are incompetent to stand trial because of their mental health.
Crazy.
And I think that is the new frontier for law enforcement and de-escalating training. And sometimes it just doesn't work for the best of us. And it turns into a deadly situation very quickly.
Yeah, Sheriff, it's you know, funny you bring up the mental health aspect, and just the problem it is. When I was doing my Texas Commission on Law Enforcement licensing courses, some of my in-person academy stuff I had to do from the state legislative session that was passed is the crisis intervention training and also de-escalation. Those were two like the main things that I had to be in person for. And I think their instructors that were putting on the academy really did a great job saying, like, hey, at the end of the day, if a crime has been committed, whether mental health is part of the equation or not, they are going to go in handcuffs and they need to go to jail. We've got to work things out from there. But I think it's, you know, Texas is really leading the way with the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement with the standards, you know, practices for the, you know, either, you know, academy training or also the reoccurring training on the mental health crisis. So definitely want to share that with our audience. It's my own personal experience with it. And I'd like to kind of what you'd said as well, Sheriff.
Absolutely. And I think there's some other solutions out there before they come to the jail. You know, that we might be able to train. We have a diversion center, which has worked, where you can take that person to a diversion center where they'll get mental health issues right there. No questions asked. But you're right. At the end of the day, you got a violent guy. Where do you go? Where does a street cop go with him? There's no choice. And even though they may not be the best thing in jail, but we have 100 mental health professionals on duty in our jail, by the way. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're spending money and time.
That's incredible. Yeah. You've had a lot of amazing accomplishments. What do you consider your greatest accomplishment so far?
Wow. Well, I got up this morning. That was pretty good. you know, Darcy, I have been tremendously blessed. And if the accomplishment, whether I can take credit for it or not, is I have been blessed by incredible people around me, that, you know, made my, you know, my wife tells them all the time, says, you know, you guys go out and do all the work and he gets all the glory. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem fair. But I got tons of guys around me, and I mean, down to, you know, the deputies and street officers to our jailers. I mean, people who have a passion for law enforcement. And to keep those people going, if I had anything to do with that, that would be what I would say. It'd be the people.
I listen to you and I can see how driven you are and how much a team approach is so important to you. What's left? I mean, what is there any goal you have left or anything that you want to accomplish before you pull the trigger and say, listen, I'm going to go out and just play golf or sit on the back porch? What's left?
Well, I tell you, for me, what's left is I'm anxious to get this academy this new academy up and off the ground. And I want it to be a premier academy from that people look at from across the country. And I want that teaching to be premier. And that's one of the things. The second thing is overcoming the stigmas of law enforcement that I think were created by the movements of the in 2020. Is I want to recreate where people believe, I want to be a part of, it is a noble profession. It is a good profession. And we stand, like guys like y'all that are retired, we stand on the shoulders of giants and bring this back to what I remember law enforcement was. And you know, in the day where everybody wanted to be in the backseat of one Adam 12, you know, is everybody at one time wanted to be a cop. And I would love to be a part of bringing that back. And that's from a big picture, but also I'm excited about maybe some fights in Washington, if you will, and hopefully that apply to retired guys. But I'm trying to create incentives for people to come in law enforcement. And so we are talking, I say we, there's several of us talking about, hey, let's create a special tax bracket for first responders. You know, how about a 5% tax rate on them so that we can get people in this profession?
Wow. Great. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Keep fighting that fight because I'd like that one.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you got?
Yeah. So, Sheriff, I'm glad you brought that topic up in 2020. So doing 40 years in law enforcement, I met 26, 27 in that area. You know, we've run into many of an individual that have come up to us and thanked us for what we do. And it felt like in 2020, that kind of transitioned. It was almost like the administration was trying to take that away from law enforcement. They were trying to, you know, ostracize us and make us into the criminals or make us into the bad guys. I love the fact that you said that, and thank you for saying that, because I would love to see that come back as well. There was nothing more that made me feel more pride. I mean, we don't get a lot of notoriety. We don't get a lot of good jobs or attaboys in what we do on a day-to-day basis, considering what most law enforcement officers do. But when somebody does come up to you and says, thank you, you're pumping gas, and they're like, hey, thanks for what you do, I used to appreciate that so much. So to all the officers and out there on the streets right now, there are people out there that truly do appreciate what you guys do every single day. So thank you for saying that. Going back to your 40 years of law enforcement, you've probably run into a lot of critical incidents during that time. Is there any one critical incident that stands out the most to you? And would you like to talk about that?
Well, let me see here. There have been a lot. And, you know, I would say to you that it was really strange, as an incident that happened 25 years ago, actually closer 26 or 27 years ago. And I'd done a lot of these before, but I was one of the first people on a scene. And I mean, this is just, you know, I look tragic scenes, and it was a double suicide by two 13-year-olds. That was a boyfriend girlfriend thing, Romeo and Juliet deal. And I remember youth death scenes are always awful. But, you know, that one in particular where these kids planned it, and it was something, she passed and was going to ninth grade and he wasn't. And that's what the issue was. And as I remember that scene and all the people on that scene, there was a ton of emotion because there was a lot of dads, including me, that was there that had a daughter that age and, or had a son that age. And, so there was a lot of debriefing and tough. That was a tough scene. So that's one that jumps to mind. And, you know, and these were seasoned veteran guys that had been around and seen a lot. But it was this was such a waste and just awful. It was all that. And I probably was looking for something a little bit more funner, but,
no,
you know,
no.
We've taken down some bad guys, but
No, I mean, that one hits home to probably everybody on this call and everybody that's going to be tuning in, all the law enforcement officers across the United States. We've all had that one or two or 10 or 50 incidents where, you know, I was a road trooper. So I came across a lot of families, a lot of, you know, major motor vehicle accidents where families were killed, where children were killed. I've had young babies hit by cars and I was there 30 seconds later and, you know, we rush them to the hospital and try to save them and do everything we possibly can. But sometimes, you know, it's just, it's out of our control and it's in God's hands, right? But those types of incidents, you know, people don't realize the psychological factor that that has on law enforcement officers in this country every single day, and why mental health is so important to our officers as well. So I appreciate you bringing up a story like that.
Chief, I'd like to jump in because like you, I mean, for 27 years, you see it and it accumulates, right? And it's another call after another call after another call. It's not just one thing. You're seeing it constantly. What advice do you have for the officers, like Mike said, that have been looking at this, has been seeing it, been experiencing it? Because it's not things you can go home and talk to your wife about. Most of the time back in the day, you would just talk to your buddies about it. And you really didn't get any professional help. What advice do you give to officers that maybe could be experiencing something or the accumulation effect of seeing it for so long?
Well, as I talk to officers in probably not too sophisticated terms, is we all need dumping grounds. We all need a dumping ground where we can go and just talk through an incident and talk it out. And for one, I mean, that's one, is I also encourage officers to participate in debriefs. And we try to do debriefs with like victims assistance people where you're sitting in the room with no bosses and let's talk about it. And also, I have chaplains that are wandering around all the time and, they do a great job. And I know that they spend a lot of time counseling. And we also have, a professional psychologist that they can go to. But we always, it's interesting that you brought that up, is that we're always looking for that next wellness possibility. What is it that we can do to do this? With active suicides in law enforcement now, very close to what we're seeing in veterans, we've got to do something. And I was reading just the other day that normal people not in our business, you know, they will have two or three critical incidents in their lifetime. And I shared with them, I said, we're a major county and our FTO program is 17 weeks long. They will surpass that in that 17 weeks. They will see, unfortunately, those critical incidents, whether, you know, it's the dead baby or the, or whatever it is, a horrific accident or shooting or something that'll happen within the 17 weeks. So we've got to compartmentalize to a degree. We've got to teach how to relate to our spouse so that we don't become isolated and see that family destroyed. We do offer marriage counseling because, as we all know, that's a huge toll. Law enforcement's a huge toll on a spouse. And, so that's some of the things that we're doing, but we don't have the market cornered, but I wish we did.
Yeah. That'd be a nice thing to get rid of altogether, wouldn't it, Chief?
Yes.
Trey, I'm going to give you the last question.
Yeah. So Sheriff, for any young men or women in law enforcement that are listening to us right now that are aspiring to be a chief of police or a sheriff one day, what is one piece of advice you would give them, both being a chief of police and now a sheriff?
Well, as chief of police, as we saw in Minneapolis, if I may, you have got to make the decision to do the next right thing. And that means you should expect to get fired every day of your career. And so expectation to do the right thing and expect to get fired because of it, and wear it with honor. And to somebody that wanted to be sheriff it's twofold. They've got to be political. So they need to be out there in the public. The people need to get to know who you are. You need to do all those things. And at the same time, I would so encourage both chief and sheriff to invest daily in leadership habits and look at leadership, look at the different, you know, all the books out there, all read them for goodness sakes, go to the courses, do whatever you need to do, but invest in leadership so that you learn how to deal with people and how to lead people.
Awesome. Yeah. Phenomenal insight, Sheriff. We really appreciate it, sir.
Yeah.
Great. Man, I've enjoyed it, guys. It's good to see you. And Darcy up there in Detroit.
Yep.
Michael Bouchard.
Yep. Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
And mine also.
I'll tell him you said hi.
Please do. Have we got time for Michael Bouchard's story?
Yeah, for sure we will. I can't wait to share it with him. Go.
He called me a couple of years ago and said, hey, do you have a relationship with Governor Abbott? And I said, yes, I do. Now, to remind you what Governor Abbott was doing a couple of years ago, he was sending those buses all over the country full of illegal aliens, right? And he said, can I send you my mayor, Detroit mayor's phone number, and you give it to him and you think he would call? And I said, I don't know, but I'll be glad to get it to him. And I said, Michael, I'm curious. I said, what does your mayor want with my governor? He says he wants him to know that Detroit is not a sanctuary city.
That's right.
And we do cooperate with ICE.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough town to send people to, so I get that one.
Yeah.
I shared that afternoon with the governor, and he laughed, and he said, well, we'll see.
Love it.
That's all I care.
I'll send him your best, all right, Chief?
Please do.
Let me ask you this. What's your final walking out the door story for us? What is your nugget that you can give not only us, but to all our listeners, our subscribers? What didn't we cover? What does everybody need to know about you that we didn't ask?
I don't know. You guys, we went through it. I'm not as exciting as a lot of people think.
You got to share with the group how you personally know Chuck Norris. I mean, that's a big, but feather in the cap right there. So,
well,
have you fought Chuck Norris?
I have not. okay. I have not. I think I've been hit by him once. His hands are still very, very fast. Walker, Texas Ranger is his office on TV was. I'm looking at it right. It's right out my window, okay. and he was here, and his brother Aaron and I are really, really good friends, and what an incredible family and incredible hero. For law enforcement. Family show, still seen three times in the world every day, and just a good family, Christ-centered family, I may add. And we buried Chuck's mom a year ago. She was 103.
Oof. What a life.
103.
Mm-hmm.
And, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, good sir, stuff, it's been great having you on. Thank you for, and we know you're how incredibly busy you are, but for spending some time with us today and getting to know you. Trey, thanks obviously for bringing the sheriff on. I mean, what a great guy.
Absolutely.
Type of guy you're going to sit down and have a beer with and just tell stories and have a great time with. And hopefully when we come to Texas, we get to do that with you.
Yeah.
We got barbecue and a beer waiting on you.
I love it. On behalf of the team, thank you for being on today. We appreciate you. We appreciate everything you do. And for all our listeners, we just want to thank you all for supporting content like this, for bringing on amazing Americans like the sheriff. And please tell all your friends, tell everybody to subscribe to Proud American Studios and watch The Hero Next Door. If you know people that this kind of show that we can kind of bring them on and talk to them and get their story and learn more about them. There's heroes out there everywhere, all across the United States. And we want to know about all of them. So, sir, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The team says bye. Everybody be safe. And thank you very much.